My name is Ricky Inslee, and I'm the community manager for USENIX, and I'm also the managing editor of Login. I have a long background with this event, however, because I used to work at SysAdmin magazine, and we were very active with USENIX also, and Linux Pro magazine and Admin magazine, so that's a bit of my background. And I also wanted to go ahead and let each of the panelists introduce themselves, and then I will have some questions for the panelists, and then towards the end of the session, I'll give us about 30 minutes where we can have Q&A with everybody here, and just make sure that you do go to the microphone when you have questions. Briefly introduce yourself, please, and make sure you're speaking into the microphone. It is being recorded, and we want to make sure everyone can hear your question. Would you like to go ahead and start down here, and each of you can introduce yourselves?
Hi, my name is Jennifer Davis. I started my career at Caltech here with Adele, and now I'm working at Yahoo. I enjoy technology in general, and I really enjoy education and mentorship.
Hello. My name is Adele Schockel, and I started out at a small startup company that was an OEM manufacturer of telco equipment, and I was doing webmastering and technical documentation. And that led to Unix system administration and disaster recovery and project management at two universities for 15 years. And I have recently pulled the eject handle on that for a little while anyway, and I am now at a cloud computing startup company. I'm also active in a couple of open source projects.
I am Nicole Forsgren-Velasquez. I am faculty at Utah State University. I have a past in software development, software analysis, and all of the associated system administration that goes along with supporting all of the things that everyone else wants to build. I also have a background in hardware performance work and RAID rebuild. Since then, I have transitioned into academia. I study sysadmins and system administration, collaboration and knowledge management, exchange in those communities, and I've been involved in some women in tech work in Silicon Valley.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth Crumbach. My day job is as a Linux systems administrator, but I also contribute a lot to the Ubuntu project. I'm one of the leaders of the Ubuntu Women Project, and I first started getting into women in tech stuff soon after I started using Linux. In 2003, I helped launch a Philadelphia Linux Chicks chapter, where we got together women in the Philadelphia area who were interested in Linux and tried to get them to come to the Greater LUG meeting. That's pretty much it.
My name is Josephine Zhao, and I in the software consulting industry. I started a software consulting company 7 years ago and have been doing Web 2.0 cloud computing consulting for enterprises as well as startups. And on my spare time, I also founded AsianAmericanVoters.org, which is a nonprofit to help Asian Americans in the city on their political issues as well as home ownership advocacy issues.
Yeah, I thought I'd start us off with some discussion about mentorship, because that is, I think, having a good mentor can make all the difference in your career, and I thought we would start with you, if that's a topic you're interested in also. So the question I was going to ask you is, what kind of skills do you think makes a good mentor, and specifically, what has a mentor done that has been helpful to you that would be good for other people to know that might translate, you know, for how they can mentor other women or, you know, new hires even?
So I actually have started expanding my understanding of mentorship. There's also this concept of sponsorship as well that's really important. But some of the characteristics that make good mentors is, one, listening, hearing what somebody, where they're at, what their actually interests are, and kind of asking them the right questions. Are they in the right place? And sometimes mentors can be your peers, and they can also be people that you look up to. I think that everyone should have mentors that they are asking and keeping on the right path for their career. Mentoring women can be challenging because we have different concerns and balances. So I also encourage people to look at sponsoring women, and this is generally you're taking the role of, you want, if you're higher up in the chain of command, not in the chain of command over someone's particular job, but if you're able to advocate for them. I've been very lucky at Yahoo to have some folks that are not in my chain that actually are advocating, tell people to come to me for questions, and that's really helped me to expand my horizons, not just in my direct line of what I'm working on, but also networking with other people.
So I have to say the best thing that one of my early mentors did was to send me to this conference. connecting junior sysadmins and junior technical people with the broader community is something that all intermediate and senior level people should find fairly easy. We know where our community is. We know where the mailing lists are. We know where the lugs and the mugs and all of those different local groups are. And just starting to connect junior folks with that broader community is opening their eyes to a broader world and giving them a broader support network, both for when they have questions about their technical projects, but also when they have questions about how to think about their career in sort of larger, non-analytical terms. The other thing is that a good mentor helps you define your goals and talks you through months or years as you work toward completing them. The sort of advice you need at the beginning of something is sometimes slightly different than the sort of advice you need in the middle and sort of slightly different from the advice that you need at the end. And getting across that last slog toward completing something is often really hard. And just having a familiar voice that says, you remember how enthusiastic you were at the beginning of this? Recapture that for these last couple of feet to take it across the finish line. And hearing that familiar voice can be very helpful. The other thing I want to mention is that when we talk about mentorship here and at LOPSA, we're talking about folks who are maybe college age or already into their careers. Broaden your definition of mentorship and mentor younger folks as well. There are high schoolers and middle schoolers and even elementary school folks who could use help with a science fair project, who could use help with summers of code, who can use help with just including that enthusiasm for technology through those difficult early years. And if you've got local organizations that you can volunteer with, to get your face out there as a women positive person in those kinds of roles as those children grow through those difficult years, you can make a huge impact for a very low time and energy investment.
I agree with what you said about reaching younger women, but I would also add you're never too old to have a new mentor. Also, right. My career had a nice boost in my 30s because I had a new mentor who actually was very influential for me. So, Nicole?
I have a few comments about mentors. I have always found it to be really beneficial to have a formal agreement with a mentor, particularly if that mentor is at your workplace. Having an arrangement knowing this will last, we're planning on having this last 1 year, we will get together at least once a month, maybe for an hour, it might be over lunch, we might do a walk and talk, but having something concrete really helps make sure it actually happens. For me, mentors have always been primarily useful in, number one, having a safe zone. I like having that, especially in a written agreement. You can include that this person will not ever share any information outside of the mentor relationship, or they won't be formally included in any kind of performance evaluations, because then I feel safer to ask questions that aren't necessarily technical related but might be organizationally related. Can I do this right now? Right now, I know that in my capacity as faculty and research, it's in everyone's best interest for me to remain involved in some of these women in tech issues, but I've been warned very, very unofficially that it wouldn't be a great idea for me to take on formal research projects addressing that. That's nice for me to know. I've always also used mentors to help me gauge priorities. I also use my management team for that, but sometimes it's nice to say, I have 7 projects people want me to work on. Which do you think would be best for me to start? And I know that especially when we're in system administration, work never ends. We never catch up. We always have a million things to do. Mentors can be a good place to look for heuristics for prioritizing. Mm-hmm. One other thing I'll say, I always try to make sure I pick mentors that have a mix. I like to have 2. So I don't always pick female mentors because I know we're stretched thin because we get volunteered for every diversity committee possible. So I also try to look at personalities, right? I want to have 1 cheerleader mentor who will always be positive and encouraging and telling me I can, you know, rule the world. And I also want to have 1 skeptic. I like having someone there who is safe, right? We already said this is my safe zone, who's going to point out giant holes in what I'm doing and what I'm missing so I catch it first. If I only have a cheerleader, I miss the holes, and if I only have a skeptic, I'm always discouraged. So I've always tried to have 2, each in a different role.
So my experience with mentors has been primarily in the open source communities I've been involved with. Through the Ubuntu Women Project, we've tried a few different mentoring strategies. We've tried wiki pages where we match people up with certain skills that they were interested in getting involved with. We've tried just randomly pairing people up. But honestly, the thing that's worked the best in our project is having it grow very organically. So when someone comes to us and wants to volunteer to work on the project, we'll pair them up with someone who has time. And generally, that person has a breadth of knowledge throughout, you know, beyond within the whole project. So they'll be able to point them in the right direction regardless of what they're interested in. So then we're able to really get people started in places in the project. Because with open source, it can be very intimidating when you first start. It looks like every single person who's involved is an expert. And you don't know where to start when everyone else is an expert. So one of the things that I found really valuable early on was finding a mentor in the project who looked like they knew everything but was willing to disclose their insecurities about what they didn't know or places where they had challenges. Because when everyone around you looks perfect, it's really hard to get started yourself. So I found that really valuable. And I've tried to, as a mentor myself, explain that to other people when they come to me and they say, well, I don't know if I can do this or I don't know if I have the skills to do that. It's really about encouraging people and saying, you know, you're not going to be perfect the first time, but if you give it a try, here's a good place to start. So we've found that to be very effective. And so we don't really have a formal mentoring program now in the Ubuntu Women Project. It's all pretty informal.
I found there are 2 important characteristics of being a mentor. One is patience. The second one is being a good listener. A lot of people are very knowledgeable, like you said, but a lot of people are not very patient. That's because they think that these questions are annoying to them and it takes time away from their daily work, right? But you have to groom mentors to understand the importance of being a mentor because that will help share the load of, you know, your daily work. You know, eventually you groom all these junior persons up and they will start contributing more and more and help your daily work, right? And then the second part is being a good listener. A lot of people teach what they know from their perspective and do not know how much is being understood or observed. So it's important to turn around to say, what's my student wants to know and how would I teach them so that they can understand?
Okay, thank you. Adele, I'll do the next one, start with you, because I wanted to follow up on what you said about coming to Lisa and the networking opportunities. And so the question is, what networking do you think has worked well for you in your career? Has it been events, or do you have online communities, or are you networking locally? And so I would just like to hear some networking tips that have worked well for you in your career and what you've gotten out of these networking connections that you have.
So all of the above. I attended an early in my career, Lisa, and one of the things I did was I actually looked up all the different companies that were in the exhibit hall and checked out the what was then fairly early-looking websites talking about who was at their companies and what their backgrounds were. And quite a few of them were either active in Usenics or had written O'Reilly books or had written the short topic series, which was a much shorter series back then. And so those sorts of names, I stalked the blogs. I won't say I stalked the people, but I stalked the blogs, and I found a whole lot of really quality reading that way. And most of those people who were sort of the movers and shakers at LISA were also the movers and shakers at a lot of other conferences. They were teaching classes and giving papers, and all of the interesting technical meat of sort of that clump of people that was just phenomenal, that first conference, it gave me a hook to get into all of this other technical reading that was just then becoming very, very readily available on the web. The other thing is that the local groups, I had trouble getting to. At the time, I had a very unreliable vehicle, and those of you familiar with Los Angeles public transit know that it has its limitations. And also, there's an intimidation factor in going alone to an unknown place after dark to go meet people you don't know. And I think that holds true of everyone. Most people who are not native extroverts would be slightly intimidated by that situation, let me just say that. So I sort of lurked on a couple of the local meetup mailing lists before I went there in person. And some of those lists were kind of in a confrontational tone at the time, and I put off going to those meetups. The mailing lists that happened to be sort of in a flame-free period, I went and met those folks in person first before I met the folks who happened to be in a very deep philosophical disagreement on the mailing list when I happened to look at it. It turned out that both groups were very friendly, but the initial tone of the mailing list I stumbled into was a little off-putting. I also network online quite a bit. It's easier than travel for me. So I haven't gotten a chance to go to as many conferences as I would have liked. Working in academia has its benefits and has its drawbacks, and sometimes there's a lot of funding for sending staff to conferences, and sometimes that well is just dry. And so the fact that more and more conferences are streaming content and are making presentations and technical papers available online means that even if your workplace can't pay to send you in person to these conferences, you can still participate in the community. And some of the sessions have actually included sort of remote participants' ability to answer back into the session and pose questions during the Q&A session and that sort of thing. And conferences that are doing that are really enabling people everywhere to participate in ways that weren't previously available. And that's a really important networking opportunity that most people don't really initially think about when they think about going to conferences. One of the things that has struck me this LISA, because I haven't been at this particular conference in some time, is that I have some really good friends that I haven't seen in 6 to 10 years that I may have talked to a few times online, but when we get together in person, there's a spark there of, oh gosh, let's talk and get caught up and tell each other war stories about all of our 10 years of employment experience and volunteer work and all that sort of thing. And as much as I like the online interactions and as wonderful as they've been, it's not quite the same as meeting over drinks. So I don't know quite whether to recommend one over the other, but a mix of both.
Nicole, yeah.
So the question is, what kind of networking has worked well? Any kind of networking. Whatever works for you. My biggest recommendation is to not underestimate the power of networking. Mm-hmm. Knowing someone, meeting with someone, it can be asking for new techniques or new technical toys or ways to blow off steam or just someone to vent with about how much you want to strangle your users, which I think I did two nights ago and I feel much better about right now. Any networking is valuable, right? If you have some kind of after-hours meetup group that you can go to, that would be great. Because this is a Women in Tech panel, I might echo something that I think Adele said the other night. If your organization wants to put on a networking event and it's off-site and it involves alcohol, don't be surprised if not as many women show up, right? That is a less safe place for us to show up, especially if transportation isn't provided, especially if it's late at night, especially if it's somewhere that we aren't familiar with. That said, I love attending conferences. I always do best in the hallway track. My first introduction to Lisa, I know a few of you in the audience probably remember, and your IC laughs, so yes, you do remember. I was thrown right into the deep end in the hallway track one day, and it was fantastic. I mean, it was great. In terms of networking for work or anything I've done professionally, I always try to make sure I have some kind of networking that is related in some way to my organization and people I know at work, and I always try to make sure I have some kind of network that is also unrelated, right? I have something inside of work and something outside of work, so I can kind of see both perspectives.
So I am really, really shy. So when you talk about networking, I say, oh no. So I will say some of the things that have been super helpful to me, networking-wise. I go to a lot of sort of local groups, like meetup type things. And the ones that I've found most valuable are ones that don't just dive into a presentation. They first go around to attendees in the room and ask them to introduce themselves. Because normally I won't talk at an event because it's scary. But if I'm asked to introduce myself, then people know who I am and they know what I'm working on, and it's much, much more likely that I'll end up in a discussion after the event or over pizza or something, whereas I might just go home otherwise. So I'd say if you're running an event and it's small enough where you can do introductions, that can be super helpful. And I've met lots of really cool people that way, too, who also were probably too shy to speak up initially.
I agree with everyone here that networking is, I think networking is everywhere. All you need is an inquiring mind. You know, you can network anytime, online, offline, any minute on the passing or at the conference. All you need is truly be interested in what the other people are doing. And then in turn, they will ask you what you're doing. So that's the exchange of information, and that's the building of trust. It doesn't take a lot of effort. But of course, there's no other better networking venue than being at a conference like Lisa, where there's a concentrated hub of information and face-to-face exchange.
So Lisa was one of my first opportunities to experience networking. And one of the things that was great about the experience was people like Tom Limoncelli, Rowan, Mike, listening to what I had to say. And it was active listening. And it made it a great experience, and it made me look out for more. I, too, am very shy, although I fake it pretty well that I'm not. Networking is actually work, and it's part of the work that you should do for yourself to ensure that you have a good career and you're doing the things that you want to do. So one of the things I encourage people to do for networking is to attend the BOFs. It is, you know, especially if you're an introvert at the end of the night, you're kind of wanting to go hide after the conference. But that's where you're going to meet lots of people and have that opportunity to talk to them one-on-one. I also have been involved in organizing things for Bay Lisa, and that was definitely a lot of work. So getting involved with some of the organizations that are in your area that you're passionate about gives you an opportunity to meet and connect with other people. I also encourage people to step outside of their boundaries, the things that you work on or just other interests you have. Conferences like Strata RX, I recently attended, and it was a great place to talk about other things. You can see how you can incorporate other technologies into the work that you're doing or how to view things differently. And you meet a lot of very smart people who aren't doing exactly what you're doing. So Google Hangouts, love Google Hangouts. It's a great place to actually connect with people. Jordan Cecil started this Hangops, so people who are interested in hanging out with other system administrators, especially if you're remote working, it's a great place to connect with people but still be able to network. Open yourself up to being with other people. in your everyday environment, you may not see a lot of people that are like you or having your experience. Going to places like LISA or other conferences or meetups, it allows you to see that you're not so different and that you have common things to share and you can get through some of the difficult times.
So the big takeaway here is that everyone should come to LISA. Okay, the next question is, obviously, thank you for all the men who are here, and obviously all the men that have come here are interested in being part of the solution and helping their colleagues or perhaps having more diversity in their workplace. And so my question would be, if you could offer some advice to male colleagues on one thing that would be helpful for them to do for a new hire, a woman or, you know, some other new hire to, you know, make them feel comfortable in the workplace. And then what is something that a male colleague needs to be more concerned about not doing, something that can turn off a new hire, particularly a woman? Nicole, would you like to start with that one?
Sure. Okay, a few ideas. So some women say, I want to be treated just the same, I want to be treated like the guys, make all your crude jokes around me. Some women are different. Go ahead and ask her. If you have a new woman on the team, go ahead and ask her what would make her comfortable. Because each of us are different, right? Just because you had one woman you've known that you've worked with in the past is one way, it doesn't mean all of us are the same. I would say the best thing you can do is be an ally, right? If we see studies over and over again that sometimes women get silenced in meetings or we say ideas and they get ignored. When that happens to me, I don't think it's because people are purposely trying to ignore my ideas. It's probably something that's been cultured. You know, it's just a part of our socialization. But if you see it happening, be an ally and be the one to speak up and say, you know, Nicole just said this in the meeting, this is a great idea. Or Adele just said this and this is a great idea, can we address it? Can we think about it? Or if you walk past and you see an uncomfortable exchange or an inappropriate comment, it can be really uncomfortable for me if I'm the only woman in an area to call people out on that. And so if someone else can call it out for me or say, I don't know about that joke or I don't know about that comment, it can help kind of diffuse the situation and not just call more attention to the fact that I am now other and I am the one that has changed the dynamic that used to be here before.
I think one of the things I can say is I think a lot of people go into panic mode when they see a woman who's come into their technical sphere, and the first thing they want to say is, oh, you're a woman. I want to advise against that because I know that I'm a woman and I hear it all the time. And you know, you get into a situation where you're going for an interview and every single interview panelist talks to says, huh, I don't think we've ever had a woman here. And I appreciate the knowledge that I will be coming into an environment that's, you know, all male or whatnot. But maybe if you can organize it so only one person tells me that, so every single step of the way is not reminding that things are different. It also sets sort of a tone that feels a bit negative, at least for me when I get into these situations. Because you start wondering, you know, why am I the only woman? Is it because there's a certain thing about the environment here that's makes women uncomfortable? And while I can ask things like that when I'm joining a group or joining a company, just being aware that the woman in front of you has probably heard before that she's the first one coming into the company.
I agree with Liz, yeah. So I think conferences like LISA and a panel like this, it totally help showcase women in our workforce, because usually we are the lone soldiers in our workplace being women. And so I think there are two things that everybody can help a fellow women coworker feel better is, first of all, help them open up, you know, talk about things that make, you know, them, you know, that they're familiar with. And then the second part is to help them validate their technical expertise, because a lot of people don't feel comfortable unless they have proven themselves. They spend the first 3 months trying to prove that they are relevant, they can perform the job. So if you can help that process, you can totally help the fellow coworker build up their confidence. And then, you know, everything goes well from that point on.
So I have a few things to say about this. One of the things that as men or even women in the workplace, things that you can do to help encourage women in your workplace, one, starting out with interviews, women communicate differently than men. And actually, that sounds like a binary, but really it's we all communicate kind of differently. But on the scale of things, when women say we, a lot of times people will look at somebody who says we in an interview and say, oh, you didn't really do that. Don't assume that just because a woman says we did this or we accomplished this, it doesn't mean that they didn't have a very active part in it. But a lot of times women won't take the credit for everything, whereas men might say I did this when they did have help. Like Nicole said, when you are in a meeting, pay attention, not just in meetings, but all the time. Pay attention to the women in your environment, and don't stalk them, but pay attention and see what is the experience and put yourself into their shoes, like what would that feel like? If you do see something that doesn't seem quite right, call it out, say it's not okay. You know, whether you need to do that publicly or go to the person privately that's causing whatever kind of problem, just make sure that you kind of be on the lookout, be the advocate for the women in your environment. Another really important thing is, and this might be a little bad to say, but if you don't know a woman well, like if it's not a friend, a very close friend or a relative, don't comment on her appearance. Some women like you to say that's a nice dress you have on or your hair is, you know, whatever, but some women don't like that. And it's better to just, in my mind, to just assume unless you're on a very good relationship with this person, don't assume that proximity. You wouldn't say a nice pair of pants to a guy, don't do it to a woman.
So trying to get new staff members comfy in your workplace can start in the interviews, absolutely. Also, the first day of work, if you've got company t-shirts, or I know that this has come up in every one of our talks about women in computing, but if your company does not have logo wear in a women's cut, talk to whoever is buying them and figure out why, because the default person that fits into the shirts that your company or organization is making has a lot to say about your company. I was rather astonished and thrilled with my little company. We're small and we're growing fast, and we had to do t-shirts for our recent conference, and we not only did women's polos, which I'm currently wearing, but two different styles of women's t-shirts, one of which is the little curvy baby doll that some women like to wear, and one is a much boxier, modest, but still woman-shaped cut t-shirt. And the few women who are in the company are all very thrilled about this, and the women at other companies that I tell this to kind of get very envious with me that I have the opportunity to work at this company. The other thing is, this is kind of a difficult thing to say. Often, the women that you're working with have had to be trailblazers. There's, you know, first wave feminism, second wave feminism, third wave feminism, and all of that. Men and women who have been part of those waves have ended up being the educational force in their workplaces for decades. And those of us who are up here on the panel have kind of taken the responsibility right now of being sort of the educational arm of random women everywhere in tech, which is kind of a big responsibility. If you have one woman coming into a staff full of male colleagues, they may or may not be willing to be the educator of your group about women's issues in your company. If they have had to do that teacher role and do sort of feminism in the workplace 101 over and over and over, it gets kind of tiring. Now, they may enjoy it, but they may not. And thanks to the web, there are resources where you could read some of these conversations rather than having to have the one woman in your group say them over and over and over again. So there's keywords that you could read up on. Feminism 101, the Geek Feminism Wiki, the definition of derailing. If you've never actually read that definition, or your coworkers have not actually read that definition,
and
read the definition of that. Yeah, gaslighting.
Becoming
an ally, not just of women in your workplace, but of diversity in general in your workplace. Becoming an ally of diversity. And the phrase, check your privilege. If your coworkers don't know this phrase, have them look it up online before they ask the one woman on staff what it means.
Great, thank you. My next question, we'll start with Liz on this one. What bit of advice have you received, or training or education or specific skill has helped you? The theme of this panel is advancing women in computing, and so what has been helpful? In my case, for example, I had an employer who was a mentor, and after we had conference calls, he would call me back in private and say, why didn't you speak up on the call? I didn't hear you contribute on the call. And another thing he did that was very helpful for me in my career was he encouraged me to do some public speaking, which I was horrified about having to do, but he encouraged me, and it ended up being very good for me on many levels. So what kind of examples would you have along those lines?
Sure. So the first systems administration job I had, I actually got through the Linux users group I was part of. And so, the first thing is that my boss gave me an opportunity. I had tried applying at other places, and I didn't have a lot of professional experience at the time. I'd done a little contract work. But the first step was, him recognizing that I could, become a junior sysadmin at the company, and then bringing me on board. And then when I started at the company, he immediately paired me up with the senior systems administrator at the company, who was able to take, we were a tiny company, but he was able to take time to actually train me, not only to do the really work-specific stuff, but some of the core systems administration tasks. So immediately identifying the need that for a mentor and training at that level in my career was super important. At that company, they also, like you, encouraged going to conferences and speaking at conferences, which also was pretty scary for me, but now I do pretty often. And so I was able to get paid time off to go to those conferences, and it was it really helped build my skills and get me out to more conferences and meet a lot more people. And then also the company's been very supportive of my work in open source. And it's been really helpful career-wise, my open source work, because since I am someone who, may not speak up quite so much at a conference, I talk way too much on IRC. So working on online projects has been really good for me, and that I've had a flexible enough work schedule so that I could attend open source meetings during the day and then just work a bit later. So having a flexible schedule has been really helpful in the work I've done in open source and making sure that that part of my career is being developed and is supported by the company I'm working for.
So one of the things that skills that a mentor should have is to help the other people to create a tailored roadmap of where they want to go in terms of career. Help them set a goal and then help them find ways to get to that goal. And then one thing is that I found a lot of people give up. They have this goal, but then they can't find a way to accomplish that goal, and they just simply give up. So one of the things that mentors should do is to urge them to stick with that goal. You can be flexible with how you get there. You can change all the parameters of different ways to get there. But the important things is try to make it happen. And then one of the things that mentor's responsibility is to find how the person can tweak all those parameters. And, once you get to that level of goals, then it really totally changes that person's perspective on how they view the career and what they think about themselves.
One of the most important things I had a mentor tell me was on examination of a somewhat strange interview, the aftermath and discussing good things and bad things, he actually asked me this very interesting, or he told me something very interesting. He said, you don't want to go there. That's not interesting. That would be stepping down. And I thought, what does that mean? And we talked about it, and it was eye-opening. It basically made me kind of re-examine, where am I and what am I doing and where do I want to go? It's not just about trying to find, you know, the next thing to go to, the next thing to do, but kind of figuring out, oh, here is where I'm at. And here are the steps, not just the big goals, the things you want to accomplish, but also those little steps of like setting yourself on the right path. So it's basically examine where you are right now and where you want to go and how you're going to get there.
So it's like taking more active steering role, driving your career, as opposed to seeing where it takes you. It's giving it direction.
Exactly. It's basically actually understanding that you've gone far. Just, you know, where you're at, where you start at a job, that title. The title doesn't define you. It's the things that you've accomplished, the things that you've done, and that may not fit into some, like, blurb, but you should understand where you're at.
Thank you.
So I should admit that I am sort of a process-driven person in a lot of ways. I figure if I'm going to do something more than twice, I'm going to write down how I did it so my future self doesn't have to remember it. And that sort of personality type can fall into a deep grooved rut of, well, this is how I do things. This is what I do when I go to work. This is how I do my job. This is how I think about my career. And one of the things that has been invaluable to me is having people around me who encourage sort of hacker culture and maker culture and tinkerer culture, who have reminded me that it's very important for me to get out of the let's make this repeatable and efficient and resourced properly kind of a mindset about my career and about my projects at work, but also that there's a sense of play that comes from tinkering with things and putting things together in different new ways and taking them apart, even though you may not be able to put them back together again. Don't try that on production systems. But, you know, that sort of mindset of, well, I may not be an expert in something, I may not be certified in something, but I can build a test bed in a virtual box inside my laptop and just frob the dials and bang on it with a hammer and see what it does. That notion that it's okay to tinker with things and build things for the express purpose of breaking them to figure out how they work is something that, as a sort of process-oriented person, doesn't always come naturally to me. It used to all the time when I was a kid and I had lots of Legos and was constantly building little gear things, but I lost that somewhere in college, and recapturing that in my career and having hobbies where I'm tinkering with things and taking them apart has actually helped my career, even when I'm not tinkering and doing skills that are directly applicable to my job.
I would say that some of the best things that my management team has ever done for me is challenge me. You know, and if there's a project that I'm excited about that's particularly challenging, give me support and stay out of my way, and then hold me accountable. And I've always been able to accomplish way more than I kind of thought I could, even though sometimes I was faking it, and more than they thought I could. And I had an internship, and I had a team of 6 people in Minsk, and neglected to tell my management team when we lost our translator, because I'll figure out a way to make it work. And it did, and it was fantastic, and it was probably one of the best projects I've ever worked on. On the other hand, I've also always really appreciated my managers that have pulled me aside at the end of the year in my performance review, and we go over all the things I've accomplished, and then they've said, okay, you need a hobby. Like, you need something to do. Because it gets really exciting and really challenging, it's great, but I can't do it all the time, or I'm just gonna burn out. I'm gonna crash and burn really hard. So it's nice to have the mix between support and encouragement and holding me accountable. You know, you said you could get this done, I want to see the deliverable, and also, okay, you really have to take a few days off.
And you want wanted to add something to what Adele said.
Yeah, your comments about the Lego building really touched something. I have a great set of coworkers, and last year, after talking about stuff for so long, they actually helped me build a table. And like, I was afraid of those, you know, machines. And it was so fun. And now I'm learning to solder and build things. And it's just an incredible feeling. If you have this sort of support network that helps you like step out of your boundaries and try something new, go do it. We're allowed to touch the power tools. It's great.
The other day when we had the BOF, somebody asked me about recruiting women, because often we will hear that there weren't more women speakers because they didn't submit proposals, or we don't have more women working here because no one applies. And so he was asking, how do we recruit women without saying we want women to apply? Like, how do they reach them with a job? Would you like to start, Josephine?
I think I've worked in a lot of, lived in many other countries and worked in some other countries. I think America is the most equal opportunity of the world. It's equal output, equal pay, equal effort, equal recognition. So this is, I personally contest to that. And so when there's very few women that submit their resume to, you know, a higher position or to be a speaker, that's usually because women have their own obligations. We have families, we have kids, we can't dedicate as much time as men at the workforce, and therefore we just can't put in as, you know, we can't show as much and we can't advance as fast. So sometimes it's important for employers to change their work requirement to allow flexible schedule, flexible work pace, so that women can participate in more positions and contribute in their own ways.
Should I take it next?
So I think it's an interesting question, and my answer is more to do with making things more open in general. People talked about diversity earlier, and generally, I think that when we have places where you ask for something, you're going to see a lot more of the things that you already have versus what you don't have. And to encourage women, you will get more women if you kind of follow this sort of process. One, for conferences, speaking at conferences, make the call for participation very open and instructive. Have dedicated mentors, potentially, that can help shepherd people through the process, not targeted just for women, but for everyone in general. Make the words in the call for participation be very open and welcoming. And then for people that are on the committees themselves, find and approach women that would be of good interest for the group that you're presenting to. Talk to those women. If you don't know any women, that's kind of scary, but talk to people that you do know who do know women. People have people that will be good for these kind of talks. Also, for employment at a job. When you talk to the women that you contact, don't come at it as a, hey, you're my token woman, come talk at this conference. But tell them, you know, here's the opportunity. Susan from O'Reilly does a really good quest for people to come talk. But it's basically like, we're not going to guarantee you a place at the table, but hey, we're really interested in hearing what you might have to say. And I think if we make things more welcoming and help people who may not realize, a lot of women just don't know how to put together that presentation. They don't know, they don't have people to look up to and say, okay, I can do that, because there aren't a lot of women doing it. So that's basically my thought.
And I agree with what you're saying, that you should specifically ask women to submit a paper. I found that in publishing, We didn't get a lot of proposals from women, and I wanted to see more diversity in our mix. We were having a lot of the same authors, and they were all very great, but I wanted to see new authors. And so one thing I did is at events, I would specifically ask women and some other just first-time authors, men also, to submit papers and or articles, you know, and that was how I was able to get a little more diversity, was specifically asking them, because they didn't know they were qualified because they hadn't done it before, you know.
I would echo the sort of quantifying and codifying the path for first-time presenters if you're looking for more diversity in general in conference presentations or in tutorial instructors. And I'd also like to sort of echo and sort of add an extra dimension on the flex time conversation, because some of us don't have families, don't have kids, spend Friday nights at the office for fun occasionally, and yet I would also welcome having more folks who need flexible time in the workplace to be giving presentations. There are plenty of men who have lots of obligations, or they're raising kids as a single parent as well, and those guys need exactly the same kinds of support that female single parents need. The more flexibility you can include in your workplace, in your volunteer organizations, in your conferences, in your professional organizations, the more different voices we bring to the table. And the more voices that we have, the more perspectives that we have, the stronger we are as a community and as a society and as a world and all of this high philosophy stuff. Recruiting in creative ways will increase the diversity of your workplace. If you're already doing networking professionally in your area, you know a broader diversity of people in your industry than you expect. Make sure that your coworkers and your employees know when you have a job opening that they might have friends who fit. If they're doing professional networking, or if they're volunteering with an IT nonprofit in their free time, they may know someone within that organization that's a perfect fit for your job, and that person might not have heard about it without that employee's social connection to that group. So make sure you're encouraging all of the folks in your workplace to diversify their social contacts in addition to you doing them your own diversification. The other thing, and this is an odd story, but one of the partner companies that one of my former employers was working with ran a call center in the Midwest, and they had located in a very small town, and they were having trouble recruiting. And they put their job flyers on pizza delivery boxes that were delivered after 10 p.m. They found every technical person in the entire town that way. Apparently, techie people are awake at night and ordering pizza. So think outside the box when you're recruiting. Depending on the type of skill set you're looking for, shift how you define what information technology background is when you think about it. I mean, I'm doing Unix system administration, I'm doing project management, I'm doing webmastering. My educational background is geochem. There are plenty of programmers whose official educational training has nothing to do with computer science. There are plenty of folks doing tech writing who are math majors. Think outside the box as far as the educational requirements, and think about what sort of short win professional certifications might be interchangeable for educational requirements.
Okay, I have a lot of thoughts. And some of this will be based on research that I'm aware of, so I'm also going to try to pseudo-educate at this point. One thing to keep in mind when you're recruiting women has to do with resumes. This came up, I know, in the women's BOF the other night. Lots of studies show that if we take identical resumes and then attach gendered names to them, the women's resumes are given a lower rating and a lower salary. And it's not necessarily because people who are hiring are angry or hating or whatever. It's sort of just something that's been cultured in. So removing names can be huge. If you don't have names removed, one thing to keep in mind is that generally across the board, men tend to overestimate their abilities or promise a bit more. So if I'm actually at a 6 and I'm a man, I will say I'm at least about a 7.5 or an 8. Whereas a woman, if I'm actually at a 6, I might say I'm a 5 or I might say I'm a six. So keep in mind when you do evaluate some of these resumes, not even resumes, performance evaluations at the end of the year. Have a third party evaluate if you can, or at least have a discussion, because women across the board, we never want to disappoint. And so we are always very, very, very honest or perhaps slightly critical in our assessment of our own abilities. Informal messages we've mentioned about, make sure you have t-shirts for women, make sure you have policies that work. A giant, giant flag for me is if I go interview somewhere and they tell me about all of their family-friendly policies and how they're so family-friendly and how they will let me take leave for my family and for my children. Because it almost feels as if they've thrown those, the intention is good, right? They have binders full of women. They mean well, and it's really sweet, but I don't want to go somewhere that a policy has been written for me. I don't have kids. I don't have a family right now. And I don't want to be the first one to potentially use that policy that no one has ever used before, right? That is a problem. But if we have policies that are for the benefit of everyone, like Adele said, this is much more comforting for me, because then if I end up, let's say I have a kid and I end up taking maternity leave, I don't want to be the first person who has ever taken any kind of family leave in the company. It may be there and it was for my benefit, but it further solidifies the fact that I am mother, right? And that's can be concerning. Also, if you interview me, it would be much better if you phrase things in terms of valuing a more diverse team or a more diverse workforce. If I think you're valuing me, even if it's because I'm a woman, if you value me because of diversity and how diversity of perspectives brings value to a team, and which, by the way, research does show, as soon as you add, in this case, one woman to a team, performance goes up. But if you keep telling me you want to hire me because you want more women on the team, that's another kind of a red flag. The word diversity is much more inclusive, and I hope that maybe I can also bring some, I might be the only volleyball player on the team. That's diverse. We can add other sorts of things that aren't just gendered. In terms of interview styles, this is something that is starting to get some attention because women interact differently and we perceive things and interpret things differently than men do as a whole. We know there are challenges in industry and in tech in getting women to even apply for the process or at least to drop out of the process. So we're all familiar with the stereotypical, like the Microsoft interview questions, the ones that are crazy where there's no right answer and there's no way you'd be able to get to the right answer, right? But we know that the important thing is to see how you work through the problem. These are interpreted as, by men generally, as being very challenging. You know, it's a challenge. It's an exciting problem. It's a challenge. Many times if you pose these same questions to women, it's seen as being combative. It's a personal affront. So you might want to reevaluate your interview style and your interview questions. You know, they've worked well in the past. Sure, we have a fantastic track record. If you go to HR, they'll say, these have worked well for 10 years. We have a fantastic track record. Look at your team. If they've worked well for a team that's 100% men, it's worked very, very well to recruit men. But that doesn't mean it also works very well for women, right? It's worked well for what you have right now. One other thing is to, once you're in the workforce, find a way to recognize and appreciate invisible work. There's been a lot of research that shows that women are fantastic, fantastic at getting invisible work done, right? We're the ones that go walk around and we find things and we talk to people and we make everything work. We might not think it's work, so we might not put it on our end of year performance evaluations. Managers might not notice it, and we might not get credit. And then we'll go on 2 or 3 weeks vacation and everything falls apart. Right? So if you can find ways to, even if something like that came up in an interview process, saying we really value those team members who can be the glue that holds the team together, or who can find ways of getting things done, that's a good hint to me that some of the work that I do that might not show up on my official job sheet will at least be appreciated because I can get things done. And as a whole, women tend to do much more of that. There's a lot of research that shows that happens. And we either stop doing it because we don't get valued for it, or we do it on the sly and we don't tell anyone about it because we don't get credit for it.
That was a lot of really, really good points there. You took all mine.
Sorry.
No, I'm just teasing. One of the things that I want to stress is also be realistic about your requirements, both for speakers and for employees. Oftentimes, women I've worked with, they'll look at a job description, and they'll say, well, I don't have those two requirements, so I'm not going to apply. That's not really how things work, but it's how it works in my head and how it works for a lot of women. They think if they don't meet their requirements, right, they're required. but realistically, I mean, men will go out and apply for jobs where they don't meet all the requirements. So understanding that a lot of women won't. So be realist. Try to be more realistic about job requirements. And on the conference side, one of the more helpful conferences I applied to speak at, they actually had examples of talks that they were interested in having, and they labeled them basic, intermediate, and advanced. And that was really, really helpful because some of the things that I could present on, like at work, I am the one who knows everything about DNS, right? So, I think, yeah, DNS. DNS is easy. But it was on one of the, you know, beginner topics. And I'm like, well, I could actually present on that. And it gave me the confidence to present on something. And, it, you know, a level that they were expecting for the conference. So I was able to, you know, craft a talk that was able to address the level they were expecting. And I felt confident that I could deliver at that level.
Thank you all for answering my questions. But I also wanted to open it up for the attendees to ask questions of our panelists. So if you have any questions, I want to go ahead and take the mic. Otherwise, I have plenty of other questions if nobody else does.
Hi, Colin Higgs from University of Edinburgh. I think essentially we've had the questions. We've all in the audience got an awful lot of advice. But is there any effort to capture this advice and send it out to people? I mean, you're in quite a friendly audience here, and in a sense, we've preached to the choir. But we want to do something about it, get other people to do stuff, give advice to people. Are there any efforts in this direction?
Yeah, I will take turns. So that is a great question. And the thing that is very interesting is there's lots of articles and websites out there. Adele mentioned some. But generally, if you want to affect change, you get the people to change. And the more you educate people and you get them really happy about what you have to say, and they go and talk to people, and they, so all of you have kind of got the ideas now that we have to share, and a lot of them may be things you already know, but the expectation is the culture has to change. We can't change it without all of us working together to change it.
So I have a couple of bits of wisdom to share. If you've never heard of the ADA initiative or the ADA initiative, please go look it up. It's a wonderful organization and it's making wonderful strides in a number of areas. One of the first things that they took on was crafting a sample anti-harassment policy for use for conferences. And my question to a couple of the conferences that I've participated in that don't already have such a policy is, when do you want to institute your anti-harassment policy? Before you need it or after you need it? So those organizations are working in a lot of very public ways, in a lot of very positive ways. The other thing that I'd like to mention is, if you haven't looked up imposter syndrome and made sure that all of your coworkers have also looked up that phrase, it will change how you interact with people and it will change how your coworkers interact with each other. It's a very powerful bit of description about how we talk to ourselves in our own heads. The other thing is, and this is especially important for those of you who are mentoring younger kids, or if you're parents or you have nieces and nephews, think about, in your everyday life, how many women you see and interact with in technical roles, in math roles, in science roles, in technology roles, and recognize that there is a bit of an awkwardness in interaction in the workplace. If I'm in a work group where the five men on my team are only ever interacting with a non-technical wife, a non-technical mom, a non-technical sister, and I'm the only technical woman they ever encounter in their everyday life, they're going to have a bit of more awkwardness with me than I could otherwise expect as a coworker. If you are in organizations that have other technical women in them, when you come into your office, you will not be looking at a sparkly unicorn for the first time, right? Encourage your coworkers to do the same. Encourage them to get out into groups that are more diverse, not just more women, but more different people. That way, there's less of the very human tendency to make assumptions about people that you encounter. Judge less on appearance. If you're in a place where that you know you expect everybody to look a certain way and they don't, it sets you back. Put yourself in more different situations where the diversity around you is stronger. The other thing is that there's an assumption that I found in the workplace early on. I had to wear Birkenstocks and flannel to be recognized as part of the tech team. So think about your workplace, think about your organizations that you volunteer with, think about the dress code, and think about the assumptions that you make about people, about how they dress, and just re-examine that interaction wherever you are. Encourage your coworkers to do the same.
This way? Oh, now I have two. It's very important. I kind of wanted to highlight a bit of what USENIX has been doing, which I think is fantastic. The co-executive directors of USENIX this about a year ago approached Carolyn Rowland, who's this year's fantastic chair, and asked her if she would be interested at all in helping to chair a Women in Advanced Computing Summit, and that happened during Federated Conferences. I somehow got roped into co-chairing last year, and we are both co-chairing again this summer. So I've been very encouraged to see some formal support for getting women in advanced computing together. That is not just sysadmins, it's women in any kind of computing tech field. It was fantastic. It was a day long. I encourage all of you to find, so all of the sessions were recorded. Our closing speaker, our closing keynote was Sabrina Farmer. She is in charge of Gmail for the world. You know, no big deal. It was a fantastic talk.
The videos are on our website.
And it's all on Google, Sabrina Farmer, WIAC, W-I-A-C. It was amazing. I think it was overcoming my biggest roadblock myself. It was fantastic. The men in the room all loved it, walked out, told everyone else at Federated Conferences how amazing this talk was. And so that is something I'm also doing, because I'm, believe it or not, I'm actually kind of an introvert, but the more practice we get, right, the little bit better we get at it. And it's something else that, you know, some of us are trying to do. We get involved sometimes locally, we get involved sometimes nationally. I mean, this isn't an international conference. This is what we can do. So if you know of anything, or if you know of anyone who would be interested in attending and or participating in WIAC.
I'm already trying to line somebody up.
Yes.
So along that lines, I had a real quick 10-cent suggestion. One of the best things I take away from the LISA is the short topics books to hand to management and other people that can't be here. Wouldn't it be fantastic if you guys had a short topics book on women in IT?
I think that's a great idea. Thank you. Okay, we're on it. Thanks.
Great idea indeed. I'm Jimmy Kaplowitz, currently at Google in New York. One thing I've noticed in the sort of broader community is that a lot of the sort of trendy startups and a lot of these sort of buzzword cultural movements within our community, like DevOps, part of DevOps, not all of DevOps, a lot of sort of online vibe has an excessive, even from my male perspective, excessive amount of machismo and sort of, you know, so-called bro culture, and you know, this is so easy. You know, here's just a sort of short version, and you'll figure it out. You know, let's go party all night. You know, and as much as that's off-putting to me, you sort of wonder what it's like for all of you, and sort of maybe ways to sort of help discourage that or encourage more inclusiveness in that regard, just in the broader culture of the community.
Yes, we are seeing a lot of that kind of like frat boy coding culture. I think we have a few things working in our favor. One is the legal system, right? They're getting in some serious trouble and they're getting some bad PR. One thing that's been kind of helpful to me is realizing that women in tech is important, but women in tech is just one small focused diversity group, right? Reaching out to other groups, other diversity groups, other groups that may be underrepresented, they've got fantastic, you know, they've been there for years. They've been there. They've been helping to expand the culture. Call attention to it if you feel like you can, if you're comfortable at all. I mean, I realize that it's not always comfortable for anyone to call out and say, really? We're having hazing this week and code's due next week. It's not always comfortable to say something, but if you ever can, do.
Let's take a question from the back, Mike, please.
One
second. Sorry, I didn't let her talk.
Sorry.
Sorry. So you mentioned DevOps, and I just wanted to make sure it was clear. I don't feel that DevOps, that actually has a negative connotation to it. I think a lot of people have, there's different people thinking what it means has different meanings. In fact, I love the DevOps term because it no longer has admin in the title, and I was also with Adele at the place where it somehow, as a woman in system admin, turned into you're like a secretary or something. So what I do think is important, I see a lot of bro ops or beer ops, and those kind of things seem to be less embracing of the diversity, and so it's important not to react to things so much as call things out in positive ways to ensure that people, if you have that opportunity to call it out and embrace diversity. I think John Oswald does a great job, especially with his hug ops, to kind of embrace, truly embrace diversity.
Thank you.
Okay. I hate it when people make generalizations, and I say that as a preference because what I'm about to say might sound like I'm about to make a generalization, but I've interacted with a lot of guys who tend to overstate, either to themselves or to others or both, what their qualifications and competence are. I've worked with, sometimes quite closely with, a lot of really good female computer people who are really sharp and really good, but a significant number of them tend to undervalue themselves. And I'll give you just one example. The job previous to the one I have now, my counterpart in a department that worked closely with us was a really, really good sysadmin. And there was an opening in another department on campus, and I suggested, hey, you know, you'd really be perfect for that job. And she just kind of said, oh, I'm not going to apply. They just laugh at me. And I'm happy to say, I sort of gave her a nudge and persuaded her, just throw your hat in the ring and see what happens. Worst they can do is say no. And they hired her because she was perfect for the job. And yet, so I guess what I'm asking is, when we encounter situations where somebody who more often than not is female is undervaluing their own qualifications and competence to themselves, what can we do to get them to reevaluate themselves and think of themselves in a more positive light? And there's some guys that do that too, but not very many.
Yeah, so I was working with an Ubuntu team in California, and one of the guys I'd been working with for about 3 months came to me 3 months later after we started working together and said he just realized who I was in the Ubuntu project because he read my name in a book. I wasn't doing a very good job of telling people who I was or telling people about my accomplishments, and I still struggle with that. But I think doing exactly what you did, telling her that, you know, she'd be great for this position, or, you know, showing her that these positions exist, that's exactly what women who are, you know, in that sphere need. So
that. Well, and women can do that for each other also. And it is helpful to have male colleagues do that. Like I said, I've had a mentor do that kind of stuff for me before. And I try to pay it forward now that I know that lesson.
So sometimes I think it's part of the culture of women as well as Asian culture as well. Like I came from Asia, so we undervalue ourselves. Just bragging sounds really bad. I mean, it's not a good thing, brag. But, you know, sometimes it takes a woman to change that or take an insider to change that. Many of us, women in the audience as well as at the panel, we have the obligation to go out there to be a trailblazer of many things, including to change the culture, right? To start advertising about ourselves. That's why it's another reason why women don't advance as fast at workplaces is because we are too shy about ourselves, right? So we need to change that culture from the inside out. As women, and we need to be role models for everybody else. You know, we can do this. We have come this far. We could probably tell others, you know, do the same thing. And I think this takes time. You know, it's a graduate effort. But as more and more people are doing it and the environment is more and more friendly to allow women to be more open up, I think in 10 years or something, you know, we will see a big difference.
I have to agree with that. Again, recommend that they look up the phrase imposter syndrome. And it's not limited to women. But lots of sort of shy, introverted, very capable technical people have a lot of really critical voices telling us in our head that we're not as good as other folks identify us to be. The other thing is, and this is kind of sad because my mom and I have this conversation about, you know, shouldn't we be farther along in equality on so many different axes in this society than we are right now? And she kind of apologized for all of culture and said it was supposed to be better by now for me. The change in perception and the leading by example in positive aspects of the communities, if you have sort of a macho mailing list where things are happening that you don't like, but you don't actually want to confront the person that is doing it, lead by positive example, and the really useful, cool people will follow you. Lead by example, set the positive tone of it, and again, help the next generations. Volunteer with Sally Ride Science, volunteer with Girls Who Code, give out Danica Miller's books to young girls. If you don't, who doesn't know who Danica McKellar is? Oh, wow. Who does know who she is? Okay.
See the show.
Wow. So you remember the girl next door from the Wonder Years? Yeah, she grew up to be a really, really, really sharp mathematician, and she's written math books targeted at middle school girls.
So one thing I would suggest in all the working environments that people are in, as Nicole mentioned, the invisible work help, not just to the point where, oh, you see a position that someone would be good at. Actually, let's change the culture in general and recognize people. If you see somebody doing something awesome and you don't see that they actually are getting credit or acknowledgement for it, say something. That building up of like, hey, you do awesome things will lead to them feeling that confidence that they can reach out and do more.
I had a colleague who did her resume, and I asked her if I could see it after she had updated it and she was job hunting. And I sent her back a huge list of stuff she'd left off, you know, and she wrote back and she said, God, I'm good. And she didn't even realize all these things that she had done. She just didn't think about them, you know, but it made her resume look that much more impressive. Okay. Next question, please.
Hello, Kira Begnum, Oslo University College. We don't have a lot of female graduates in our programs, but the ones that we do usually have a pretty good grade average. Yet they struggle to find a job due to partly the resume, and they don't put everything on there, and they're a little bit insecure. So listening to you, I'm thinking, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could just have them have a mock interview with one of you guys and have you guys give them advice, just one or two sessions, just to kickstart their career, you know? Because you've been through it so many times, you have all this experience, and if there would be some body or mechanism for me to facilitate them to get in contact with one of you over a distance, I think that would be just wonderful. So that's just my own comment.
Sorry, I'm a very vocal person, it seems. So I would highly encourage the Women Who Code meetings. I know there's one in the Bay Area. I'm sure all of us would be, I shouldn't volunteer for other people, but I'm happy for people to contact me and ask any kind of questions. But the Women Who Code folks, they do different kind of talks, and one of the most recent ones was interviewing techniques. They got a bunch of different mentors from across the Bay Area, male and female, mostly female mentors, and we did mock interviews and practicing, and people brought their resumes in to get reviewed, and it was just a really great, encouraging environment. So if there isn't that opportunity near you, maybe think about, especially if you're a woman, starting up something, Women Who Code.
Thank you.
Is have a topic where we do mock interviews or talk about interviewing. I'm so short. I have to stand on my tiptoes to reach this. I don't want to lower it because then he's going to come up. I wanted to bring up that women tend to internalize failure and externalize success. So we tend to give credit to everybody else, even if we're the ones that led something or did something. We say, we did this or my team did this. And when something goes wrong, it's I. And so that's just something to go along with what we've been saying about women not being as confident and not being able to brag about themselves. If we are just aware of that, that helps us understand the differences in the workplace when a woman does something really great and she's not able to take credit for it. I think we as women also need to work on being better at that. But as we are slowly getting better at that, just realize that's a big difference.
I would add that for those in the room who haven't actually heard that kind of sentiment before, I know at first when I heard folks talking about that, it came across to me as, well, you know, why do women need to be sort of pushed along into recognizing their achievements? You know, in general, that's a really bizarre statement. And it's not coming out of thin air. We're living in kind of a toxic culture that forces many of us to pay a social cost when we put our successes forward. And so it's a rational choice in some cases to downplay certain things. And the cost is not always quantifiable, and it's not something that folks are maybe comfortable talking about. But just recognize that when we're downplaying things, it's sort of... it's strategic, yeah. And while we recognize in some cases that it may hurt our careers to be less flamboyant about how wonderful we might have been on some project, there's unspoken costs that are why we're doing that. And it's not just some sort of irrational thing that women do.
Go ahead.
All right, so hopefully I can keep my comments/questions coherent here. So one of the things that I have struggled with since becoming a manager is trying to get women applicants. And it's been a real problem. I have an opening now where I didn't get a single one for a system administrator. And I'm trying, and this is the thing, like all the things that you've talked about, you're like, I do those things. I contact people, I say, hey, let people know. We have a statement about, you know, the company believes in the value of a diverse workforce. That's true. And yet we still have like completely failed to get a single female applicant. I think a part of it is, and this can be something you can comment on, is I think it's a lot harder to get women to leave jobs they're happy in because it's riskier. Because it's like, well, I know this job is a good one and I'm valued here. I don't know if that's going to be true at this other company, even though it might be a more interesting job and I'll get a better pay raise, et cetera. So if you can speak, maybe I'm full of shit, I don't know. Tell me. But related, you know, so related to that topic, you know, we joke about the binders full of women, but you know, that came you know, where that came from was a group of women executives who gave Mitt Romney, when he became governor, a list of qualified women. And I tell you, like, I would hug somebody who gave me that binder. So that's something, and I think that's something to keep in mind as things that we can do is like, okay, what are the ways we're trying to connect women to jobs, especially jobs where they'd be valued? And then the corollary to that is, I think if my theory is true, that it's harder to get women to leave, I actually would be perfectly happy with like a public shaming and praising system for companies and their gender equity. And like, please do it. And I say that selfishly because I think we'd do really well in that in my company. But anyway, I'll shut up now.
Comment, one response to binders full of women, right? Which was the one comment I didn't make earlier on recruiting women that I had written down. Find alternate networking communities. I mean, I'm sure most people here have found a job through someone or through some kind of network or heard about a job, right? A lot of times we find jobs because of people we know. Women tend to network differently than men do. So if you're reaching out to the same networks where you usually find your applicant pool and there's no women there, women are probably networking somewhere else.
Right.
Carolyn, do you have?
So real quick, if you don't have a social presence, sometimes it's important for women to leave. They need to know that the place that they're going to is going to be a good place. And just saying, hey, it's a good place, if you don't have, it's not just about and this is kind of interesting, it's not just about the marketing person or the recruiter or the CEO speaking about their company that's important. It's all of the people who work at your company who tweet about their experience working at your company. I love hearing what different people are talking about, and that's kind of the thing. We connect differently, so you're saying you do a really good job of within your company. Is it actually evidenced by what somebody could see just looking around?
Sorry.
We only have a couple minutes left.
Yeah, sorry.
So.
We're a small company. We're 30 people. The tech side's 10. So, you know, just by virtue of being a small company, I don't get the visibility that a Google or whatever would have. But so, yes, as far as I know, but no one's heard of us in general, let alone whether we have good gender policies.
I think during the break, you might want to talk to some of us out there, too, because maybe we'll have more specific ideas for your situation.
I just want to say that I went to the Niederborg Grace Hopper conference in Baltimore this year, and it's a giant women's hiring festival. So if you want women in computing, it was 3,600 women in one conference center, many of them looking for jobs. And there was a huge, what we would consider a vendor fair at LISA. It was a hiring fair. And every national lab, every big computing company, universities were all there, and they were hiring women. And the women came with resumes, and they had interviewing booths where you could set up one-on-ones to actually interview the women on site. So if you're serious about hiring women, the Grace Hopper Conference is going to be in Minneapolis this coming year. Go have a booth and see if you can find someone.
But I want to say to the fact that we might have to accept that there are less women in the high-tech industry than men. Because I went to college, I was one in 20. I was the only one woman in 20 of my class, right? And then when I went to graduate school, I was the one in 10. So you just have to be, you know, accepting that there is just going to take time for women to graduate through that ladder. And then until that happens, you know, from elementary school, we have to put more emphasis on teaching math, better at it, and then college, you know, middle school, college, and all that, all the way up. You know, it's just a part of the culture, but, you know, we're going to get there. It's just going to take time. So
we have about 2 minutes left, so these will be our last two questions.
I know Daryl. I wish I could say I planned that.
I think
your question
up.
Wins. Yes.
Let's meet out at the break. Thank you. After this drill or whatever.